Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We have our full committee present. Myself, Senator McGuire, Vice Chair, Senator Coghill, Senator Machicki, Senator...
What's his name?
Willikowski, Senator Costello. And we just have the one bill, SB 30, here today. Yes?
Pass the revisers bill along.
Yeah, we'll take up actually the revisers bill exactly today. My apologies. Senate Bill 35. Let's go ahead and bring that up today and move that out. Senator Coghill.
Madam Chairman, thank you for holding it. I had a chance to read it. So with that, I would ask unanimous consent that we move Senate Bill 35, the revisers bill, from the committee with individual recommendations, and I think it's a zero fiscal amount.
Is there any objection to that? Okay, hearing and seeing none, let's go ahead and move Senate Bill 35 with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note out of committee, and we'll take Annette Ease to sign the report. Okay, we're back on the record. And so we're back on Senate Bill 30, and actually I'm going to go to Jay Butler. Dr. Butler, and have you come forward since you're here in the room, and have you offer testimony today. And if you just put your name on the record, and thank you, Jay, for being so patient waiting through the hearing last time.
Well, you're welcome, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. My understanding is you would like a bit of a primer on medical marijuana, and I'm happy to provide that. Marijuana is sometimes used by physicians for treatment of a variety of orders. Probably the most common is neuropathic pain, which means pain that is generated by diseases of the nerves. It's also used for persistent muscle spasms. These are two predominant symptoms of multiple sclerosis, for instance. And surveys suggest that about 10 to 15% of multiple sclerosis patients use medical marijuana for relief. There have also been studies that have looked at medical marijuana and provided evidence that they reduce pain from peripheral and post-traumatic neuropathy, as well as HIV-induced neuropathy. Marijuana is also used to treat nausea from cancer chemotherapy, AIDS cachexia, which is something we don't see much anymore, but before we had antiretroviral drugs, was the severe weight loss and loss of appetite that was part of advanced HIV infection. Also, glaucoma, Tourette syndrome, and certain seizure disorders. The actual practice of recommending medical marijuana is quite variable among physicians. There are FDA-approved products that are derived from THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active, most often cited as the active part of medical marijuana, such as dronabinol, also known as Marinol, which has been on the market for about 20 years, and also Nabilone, sorry, I don't use that one very often, which has not been on the market for as long. There is also a oral spray that actually contains both THC and cannabidiol. It's actually approved in UK and a few countries of the EU, and it's currently on the FDA fast track list.
Just to interrupt you for a second, the effect of what you're describing is that some of these derivatives do not have hallucinogenic effects, if you will, or potentially the same mental effects that THC contains. That's my understanding.
The derivatives may not, the oral mucosal, the spray that's currently in evaluation would have the same effects as THC because it is THC.
And so to your best ability, when you describe them, if you could tell us those things, and just for the listening audience, because I think that's important. If there are some ointments, there are some kinds of medicinal treatments that people may be taking to offset nausea, to make people anti-inflammatories, to make them feel better. Not necessarily, when people think about marijuana, I think the traditional viewpoint is to have a psychotic effect, to sort of step outside their body in the way that they use alcohol and sort of feel different than how they feel right now. And so for medicinal effects, it may be to get away from the experience of chemotherapy, which can be to make you feel like you want to throw up. If you're an epileptic, it can be to escape the effects of seizure. If you have MS, it can be to escape the painful effects of that, those kinds of things. So to the best of your ability as an MD, if you could tell us, when you describe the different parts of what you're doing, if you could tell us what they do, that would help.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe just a little more background.
Okay.
On that. There are two different types of cannabinol receptors in the body, shorthands CB1 and CB2. CB1 is primarily in the central nervous system, including the brain and also the peripheral nerves. These are the receptors that are most often associated with some of the psychogenic effects. There's also CB2 receptors, which are in certain nerves and also on some immune cells. I'm less familiar with those, and I think in general there's less science on those.
Okay.
As well. In terms of actual use of medical marijuana, how does one obtain medical marijuana? It requires a physician statement, and I stress the word statement because I think prescription would be a misnomer. It's actually a form that is completed by the physician rather than going to the electronic health record and making an entry for marijuana or filling out an old-fashioned paper prescription. The statement requires that the physician document or actually say that the patient has one of the qualifying medical conditions that are listed in Alaska Statute 1737, which include cancer, glaucoma, positive status for HIV, or acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, cachexia, severe pain, severe nausea, seizures, or persistent muscle spasms, including those that are characteristic of multiple sclerosis. The physician does not have to specify which debilitating medical condition is present. Medical marijuana requires the patient be under care of a physician in a, quote, bona fide physician-patient relationship, according to the statute. The medical marijuana statute also has provision for caregivers if the patient are in need of help in administering the marijuana. The physician statement is submitted to the Bureau of Vital Statistics in the Department of Health and Social Services, which maintains the medical marijuana registry and issues certificates. The applicant also needs to submit a non-refundable fee, which is $25 for the first application and $20 for renewal, and a copy of their driver's license and state ID card. The same type of identification is required for any caregivers that are also going to be covered under the certificate. We sometimes use the term card or even green card. It's actually 2 3/4 inches by 8 inches, so it's a fairly large certificate that we're actually talking about. The certification is good for 1 year and can be renewed, actually requires renewal annually. Medical marijuana cards issued from other states are not considered valid in Alaska. Minors under age 18 are allowed on the registry, but a parental statement is also required. We currently have 831 Alaskans in the medical marijuana registry, including 6 minors. The medical marijuana statutes do not address how you get the marijuana or seeds if you are going to grow your own. We do not have dispensaries in Alaska as Colorado or Washington do. I think I may have mentioned in earlier testimony when asked, I've only encountered one patient in clinical care in Alaska that I recall, and that was just a couple of months ago. A gentleman who found relief from his persistent nausea related to liver disease through using medical marijuana. And I was curious how he obtained his marijuana, so I asked him, and he looked at me, pitying my stupidity, and just said, I have no problems getting it. So,
yep, that's right.
Maybe at this point I should stop. I hope that provides some overview, and I'll be happy to take your questions as best I am able.
Senator Bulikowski.
Thank you. Doctor, does a person have to reach an intoxication level to get relief if they're using it for medical purposes?
Senator Bulikowski, through the chair, it's not, I wish there was a straight forward answer to that question. There's a couple of aspects that come into play in terms of what is a level of intoxication. If we're talking legal intoxication, if we're wanting to qualify for impairment to drive, I believe Washington State, for instance, is looking at 5 nanograms in the blood. People who are chronic users generally require more, though, and there's also some tolerance that is built up. So whether or not there is impairment is required to get the medical effect, I believe, is quite dependent on the individual and their susceptibility and their experience with use of marijuana products.
Okay, Senator Cogdell.
Doctor, thank you, Madam Chair. How many cards have been issued to people under 21 at this point? Do you know?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I don't have the number for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. All I know for sure, since the law right now requires parental consent for persons under age 18, is there are 6.
Right.
It's a very, very good question.
And I think, Madam Chair, as I watch this, we are allowing adults to give marijuana to somebody under 21 if it's a medical marijuana issue. And I would propose that we say under parental consent for that very reason.
Absolutely. Any further questions? Senator Bulikowski.
Thank you. Is there any research on I guess number one, impacts of secondhand smoke from marijuana, and number two, impacts on fetus from use of marijuana?
Senator Bulikowski, through the chair. Regarding secondhand exposure to marijuana smoke, there's much less data than there is for tobacco smoke. In terms of what a person is exposed to through secondhand marijuana smoke, there is some controversy about whether or not there is such a thing as a secondhand high. There is some evidence that the amount of THC in exhaled marijuana smoke is actually very low, in part because of the way you smoke marijuana is different from how you smoke tobacco. Now, there is also sidestream smoke, which is the smoke that comes directly off the cigarette, which obviously would contain THC. There are other, if you're interested in further discussion on health effects of of secondhand exposure to marijuana smoke, there are other compounds that are recognized to be harmful that are in exhaled marijuana smoke. The question that's of greatest interest to me as a physician is trying to quantify that level of risk, and the data are really inadequate to be able to say that with certainty. The second question is also a very concerning one to me, and that is the effect on children in utero, or if you don't mind, I'll add breastfeeding children as well. THC does cross the placenta. It's also excreted in breast milk. The most recent PRAM survey, which assesses pregnancy-related risk factors in Alaska, suggests that about 7% of women who are pregnant report having smoked marijuana during pregnancy. There are some data that suggests that smaller-sized babies may be associated with marijuana exposure. It can be always tricky, though, particularly in epidemiological studies, looking at risk factors for marijuana smoking because such a large proportion of marijuana smokers also smoke tobacco.
So, good. On the secondhand smoke, if you're in a place where there's marijuana being smoked, is there any data on how long you would have to be there or how close you would have to be there to become under the influence?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, as I mentioned earlier, the data that supports the concept of a secondhand high, even though it's certainly the stuff of a lot of stories, is not necessarily well supported in the medical literature. If we're talking about and again, I think it's going to be quite variable. If we're talking about a setting where marijuana is burning and being allowed to just go into the room is going to be different than a setting where people are smoking and exhaling.
I don't know that any of those researchers have ever been to a Grateful Dead concert.
Yes, Senator Kristol.
Thank you, Doctor. I know this Department of Health and Social Services administers the Behavioral Risk Factor Survey amongst youth, and is there any talk within the department to adding a question about the use of marijuana, or are you aware of any discussion to that end?
I believe that question is on the BRFSS. I know it's on the YRBS, the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey already. The number of high schoolers who've smoked marijuana or say that they have used it in the past 30 days is actually a little greater than the number that smoke tobacco cigarettes.
Anything further, Dr.
Brock? Question?
Yes, Senator Chicky.
I just, you know, I'd scanned it earlier. I was making sure. I don't notice any mention of 1737 in the current bill. I know we have another bill coming our way, but what is there not a better way to combine the two? I mean, it looks to me like the only thing about medical marijuana in the future that perhaps we would have to deal with is the minor issue in the 18 to 21 and possible future insurance coverage if we ever get to that point. But why do we have a separate section for medical marijuana any longer once marijuana is regulated like alcohol?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, I guess if I could maybe answer a question that's a little different, and maybe it's what you meant, is do we need a medical marijuana registry? I don't think we really know the answer to that question. I think it'll probably take a couple of years to know for sure. The two instances that come to mind where I think the registry may be useful, one, as you've already mentioned, I believe, is medical marijuana for people under age 21. Mm-hmm. The second might be people who are just very hesitant to use marijuana medically without some sort of documentation that they want to show. But again, I have no idea how prevalent that is. You know, it would seem like people would not want to pay the application fee or do the paperwork if they can, in a sense, get their medical marijuana over the counter.
Just follow up.
Absolutely, Senator Michicki.
So do we know if there are other states where medical marijuana is covered by an insurance plan? I mean, I think that would make a difference, certainly.
Yeah. Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's a question I've also asked. I'm not aware at this time that any of the states, which is about half of all the states and the District of Columbia, have third-party payers for medical marijuana. I suspect the answer is probably not, but I haven't been able to confirm that yet. So I'd be happy to follow up with you as soon as I get a confirmatory answer.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And so I promised Tracy Wallenberg that I'd call on her next, and then I'm going to go to Cynthia Franklin. And Cynthia, if you just kind of hold on to a lot of the thoughts that were just echoed, because I know you have specific opinions about medical marijuana and things that you observed in Colorado that were done differently that they wish they had done different. So I'll call in Tracy. If you would go ahead and provide testimony, any testimony you'd like, frankly. You've seen a copy of the bill, the new bill that's come forward, and if you'd walk us through your testimony, put your name on the record for us as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tracy Wallenberg, and I'm the Deputy Public Defender for the Appellate Division at the Alaska Public Defender Agency. And I want just to confirm, first of all, that I'm referring to version I. Is that the version before the committee?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much again for this opportunity to testify before you today. As you may recall, I previously testified on the prior version of Senate Bill 30, and this version, which removes the defense to prosecution for certain marijuana-related conduct, is more consistent with the intent of the voters in enacting ballot measure 2. But what I really wanted to focus on was some of the inconsistencies I still see with the ballot initiative. This version of the bill still includes provisions that are inconsistent with the initiative and the will of the voters. In particular, the bill repeals, as you're aware, as was discussed on Wednesday, 1738-020, which is really at the heart of the initiative. And 020 is the provision of the initiative that really governs personal use of marijuana, and it provides that certain acts by persons 21 years of age or older are lawful and shall not be a criminal or civil offense under Alaska law or a basis for seizure or forfeiture of assets. And I think it's useful maybe to just kind of mention briefly what that allows and then compare that side by side with the bill, and in particular the misconduct involving marijuana offenses that have been proposed in this version of the bill. O2O of the initiative makes legal possessing, using, displaying, purchasing, or transporting marijuana accessories or 1 ounce or less of marijuana. Possessing, growing, processing, or transporting no more than 6 marijuana plants, with 3 or fewer being mature flowering plants, and possession of the marijuana produced from those plants on the premises where the plants were grown. Transferring 1 ounce or less of marijuana and up to 6 immature marijuana plants to someone over 21 without remuneration. And then consumption of marijuana, except, of course, consumption in public. Section 50 of the bill conflicts with this provision in a number of respects. And Section 50 is the misconduct involving marijuana offenses and the related provisions. I'm going to start by focusing on 1738-200, which is on page 29 of the bill. And that proposed offense prohibits knowingly possessing marijuana with an aggregate weight of more than 4 ounces. And it conflicts with O2O because a person under O2O can possess more than 4 ounces if the marijuana is in the form of up to 6 plants, no more than 3 of which are flowering, or it's in the form of the marijuana produced from those plants is possessed on the premises where the plants were grown, regardless of the amount. And it might be useful here to recall the definition of marijuana, which is set out in the initiative, is also set out in this bill on page 38. And marijuana is defined to include all parts of the plant. So when you make here knowingly possessing more than 4 ounces, it very likely conflicts with the part of the initiative that allows you to possess up to 6 plants, with the idea that 6 plants may very well have an aggregate weight of more than 4 ounces. And also conflicts, like I said, with the provision that allows you to produce all the marijuana processed from those plants. So defining marijuana in terms of aggregate weight, I think, is inconsistent with the initiative, which really defines it in terms of the number of plants, not the weight of those plants. And actually, defining it that way gives clearer guidance to the public, who will know that they can't possess sort of more than six plants, no more of three of which than can be flowering, but may not know or be able to control the aggregate weight of those plants. And then allowing possession of the marijuana grown from those plants, consistent with the initiative, on the premises where the plants were grown, is consistent with the idea of making marijuana a legal substance that's treated like alcohol.
Madam Chair?
Senator Clarkhill.
This is under Section 200, right?
Yes.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
All right. Maybe a question for you then. Under the section as it's written now, the online 15, it would say, or 25 marijuana plants, right? But would it be wise to say and more than 25 marijuana plants to be consistent, or do we have to rewrite that whole section?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I think, I think saying that someone can't knowingly possess 25 or more plants is consistent with the initiative. And then if you wanted to say and no more than a certain amount of usable marijuana, perhaps that's and then eliminating the aggregate weight definition may be more consistent with the initiative. In other words, you can have a certain number of plants, and you can also have a certain amount of marijuana apart from those plants. And I think that's sort of what the initiative was getting at. But I do think that ascribing some weight apart from the plants is going to be tricky because, like I said, the initiative does allow you to possess all the marijuana that's produced from your six plants, and that figure is a little bit hard to gauge.
Okay. Madam Chair, just yes. One more, just a comment. I get that, and I'm going to ask my staff to review that. We were trying to stay consistent between the initiative and the loosely defined Raven 4 ounces, basically. So do you find us stepping out if we say and marijuana plants at this level? We got 4 ounces now, and which is more generous than the initiative, and then the 25 plants, which will also be more generous than the initiative. But it's with the idea of staying within the two bounds of the initiative and the law that as provided by the courts.
I think through the chair, it might be worth thinking about or getting a handle on how, you know, whether there's a range of weights that could be ascribed to plants. Given that the definition of marijuana includes a reference to plants, but also getting a sense of how much six plants, or I guess three plants, since those will be the flowering plants, can yield. In order to determine whether 4 ounces is actually a realistic limit from those plants, if that makes sense. Because 4 ounces is the presumptively constitutional limit that's sort of been imposed, or I should say the Court of Appeals in Alaska has determined that 4 ounces is presumptively constitutional under Raven.
This would be for possession.
But I don't know if that, at least as with regards to use in your own home for personal use. I don't know if that's a realistic number when you take into account the fact that you can possess all the marijuana produced from your six plants, or whether it in fact should be a higher number. Does that make sense?
We'll try to navigate within those bounds. Thank you.
I think it is tricky to navigate.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Michicki.
What is the significance of flowering versus non-flowering?
Through the chair, that may be a good question for the marijuana policy folks, but my understanding is that flowering plants are the ones where the buds have sort of sprouted and at that point are can be harvested for processed marijuana, but I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong.
We do have Rachel Young with the Marijuana Policy Project. Rachel, would you be willing to answer that question? Did you hear the question, and would you be willing to answer that?
Through the chair, I believe Tracy's explanation is correct.
Thank you.
But.
Madam Chair, as long as she's on the line, does what was the woman's name with the institute?
Her name is Rachel Young.
Rachel. Some idea on the variation of weights between a very productive marijuana plant and a not so productive marijuana plant?
Through the chair, that weight can vary very widely. There are some marijuana plants that are the size of small house plants if they're not very well taken care of, but we have seen marijuana plants that are taller than a person, so it would be really hard to say what a standard marijuana plant looks like or weighs. And I would absolutely concur with Ms. Wallenberg's assessment that limiting the weight of a plant would be more confusing, or having that aggregate weight provision would be more confusing to the user than having a strict six-plant limit.
Okay.
Senator Wilikowski.
If you happen to be a really good gardener and give your plant a lot of Miracle-Gro, and it grows to a couple pounds, I mean, you're committing a seriously punishable felony, I suppose, or no?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's exactly why Measure 2 allows all adults who do grow these plants to possess the marijuana that is grown from their plants.
So, where do we get into that 1 ounce, 4 ounce area? Because I'm thinking a full-grown plant that's as big as a person is probably a few pounds. And, I mean, at what point do you get into that 1 ounce? Is it when it's dried? Is it when it's in a usable condition? Give us some guidance here, if you can.
Through the chair, so that distinction is between, so the marijuana that you can possess from your own plants that you've grown can only be possessed and used on the same premises where the plants are grown, ostensibly your own home. Anywhere outside those premises where the plants are located, that's the 1 ounce limit.
Senator Coghill.
Well, then I would seriously call into question. We were trying to match the 4 ounces with the plants. I think we need to go back to the initiative language on the plants, because I don't know how else we'd get that definition tightened up. Take the weight off and just stay closely to the initiative language. I thought we were going to be more generous staying within the bounds of the court cases, but I think the 4 ounces we can do, but I don't know that we can do the plants. So I would at least, as we draft these things, kind of bring that back down to the initiative language.
Yeah. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, and you and I chatted about that the other day. I actually have my concerns with the 4 ounces. Even in observing the findings of Raven, you can meet Raven with the 4 ounce limit. You just have to make 4 trips for the 1 ounce limit, right, at your home. But we don't know. So voter intent, I don't think we can assume that folks that supported the initiative would support a 4 ounce limit, right? There may be many that realize that's a fairly large quantity of recreational marijuana and may have supported it at 1 ounce and wouldn't support 4 ounce of possession or transportation. So I agree with you on going back to the 1 ounce.
Okay, so Tracy, you want to continue?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair and listening to some of the questions, I mean, one way to fix this, amend it, I should say, is to simply keep 1738020, the provision from the initiative, and exempt it from criminal penalties. So in other words, you could write marijuana offenses at a level higher, clearly higher than that was intended to be legalized in the initiative, and then clearly exempt from criminal penalties anything made legal in 1738020. That's a clean way to align with voter intent. It has the benefit of making clear that what conduct is legal, what conduct can't serve as an offense under Alaska law, and what activities cannot be a basis for seizure or forfeiture of assets. And then I would propose leaving in 020 and then removing the aggregate weight provision in 1738-260, which I think does confuse things, as has been previously discussed. This proposal would comport with voter intent, and to the extent, it would put what was passed into law into effect, essentially, and if problems arose later, the legislature would be able to clearly identify what those problems are and address those problems specifically, as opposed to sort of changing the language now without necessarily a specified reason to do so, without knowing exactly how the language might play out, and thereby undermining voter intent. And, you know, the same problems that I discussed in 1738-200A1 are also in, or similar problems are in A2, which prohibits knowingly manufacturing or delivering or possessing with the intent to manufacture or deliver marijuana with an aggregate weight of more than 1 ounce. Like I said, you can manufacture more than 1 ounce in the form of 6 plants, assuming those are more than 1 ounce. And you can deliver more than 1 ounce because you can deliver to a person over 21 up to 1 ounce plus up to 6 immature plants. And that actually, that delivery provision is actually clarified in the next statute, MIM 2, 1738-210 prohibits somebody from delivering more than 1 ounce of marijuana and six immature marijuana plants.
Madam Chair.
So those two provisions with regards to delivery are actually inconsistent, the next one being kind of more consistent with the initiative than the higher offense in 1738-200. And I just note that you can actually, under the initiative, possess with intent to deliver. That's the provision that allows you to possess all the marijuana that's been produced by the plants you've grown on the premises where you've grown them. You can have all the marijuana grown from the plants and intend to deliver that to someone else, as long as you don't deliver more than 1 ounce or more than 1 ounce to any given person.
Senator Michiki.
Ms. Wallenberg, I have it through the chair, please. I have a question. So I was a little confused on the delivery option. I read the initiative. But if we're regulating like alcohol, in what situation can a package store deliver to a household?
Through the chair, I think perhaps those, I think that the marijuana facilities are governed both by these statutes and by the prior statutes. My understanding is that they can't transfer, maybe that's a better question, because I haven't focused too much on the marijuana facilities. Sort of, I focused more on personal use. Maybe Ms. Young can answer that question. I assume that they can transfer up to 1 ounce in exchange for money. But she can correct me if I'm wrong.
Ms. Young, can you answer that question?
Through the chair, can the question be repeated, please?
Yes. I mean, the initiative leads me to believe that the voters' intent was to regulate marijuana like alcohol, yet I would love to call my package store on a Sunday afternoon and have them drop off a couple of cases of beer while we're watching the game, and I'm unaware of them able to do that. So I'm just wondering about the inconsistency here. It looks to me like someone can literally come to your home and deliver marijuana, but unless I'm missing something, that's not regulated like alcohol. Am I correct in that assumption?
Through the chair, to clarify, you're saying that for alcohol, someone cannot come to your home and, like a delivery person, like a deliver pizza guy, but for alcohol, could not come to your home and deliver you alcohol, but that seems to be the case with marijuana. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's my question.
Okay.
I guess I should, it'd be easier to say the point of sale cannot be at my home.
It's a weird one.
Correct. Through the chair, it appears the language of the initiative is broad enough to allow delivery services like that. However, I believe that such delivery services are prohibited in other legal marijuana states. And I would have to, I haven't done an analysis on this specific question. I would love to come back to the council, to the committee and let you know, with certainty whether that type of delivery service would be permitted under Measure 2.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. And I mean, it's an interesting point, but by the same token, if we're regulating it like alcohol, you can go to the package store and load up the whole back of your pickup with beer if you want. So it's, whereas marijuana, we're limiting it to 1 ounce, right? So we're not truly, I guess, regulating it like alcohol in that regard.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Very good point. Senator Coghill.
From what I see, this is not a license transfer necessarily. This could be anybody over 21 years old can transfer 1 ounce or less and up to 6 immature plants. So it looks to me like if, as long as you're only delivering less than an ounce or 6 plants at a time, you could be in the delivery business. It's just that you couldn't be carrying any more than that at any one time. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, was that a question for me?
Yes, please. Thank you. If we go back to 020, is what I'm looking at is 020. It looks like it's just, and Madam Chair, I can restate that so she can catch it.
Sure.
It looks like as they could transfer an ounce or less, 6 immature plants to anybody who's 21 years or older, and that does not require a license, the way I understand it. So it's just an ounce or 6 plants at a time could be transferred day after day after day or hour after hour after hour. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, that would have to be without remuneration, however. So if someone is transferring ounce after ounce after ounce, that would not be, it wouldn't be for a paid service, or it wouldn't be for the marijuana would not be for purchase, because under that personal use section, that's all activities that are not commercial.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I just wonder out loud, Madam Chair, this is not for a question, but could they charge for the delivery service and not for the marijuana? I don't know.
Through the chair, schemes like that, That would not be, it would be a sneaky way to try and get around it, but in Colorado, cases like that have not been upheld. So I think that courts or, you know, law enforcement who saw someone offering up a delivery service in which the delivery was a fee that was similar to what the marijuana would have cost if the marijuana were not a quote-unquote gift, I think they would see through that scheme.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. So we start the discussion there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Just to clarify once again, I would like if you possibly could spend a little bit more time on understanding that the delivery is, in fact,
pizza.
Neighbor to neighbor, and not the pizza delivery van.
Yeah.
Of, I mean, I can see the logo now, right?
Pizza.
So I would like to understand that, because that frankly would concern me. I don't think that's the intent, and I may not understand that, but I don't believe commercial house-to-house delivery was the intent of the initiatives. So I'll be patient, but I'd love to just see your evaluation of that point.
Through the chair, absolutely, Senator. I'd be happy to get back to you on that point.
Okay, Tracy, anything else?
Madam Chair, yes. I would like to comment on a few more things if I'm not taking up too much of the committee
time. If you could wrap up, that'd be great, though, just because we do have others that want to testify today.
Sure, and I appreciate Ms. Young stepping in to answer some of the questions about the initiative itself and the intent of the initiative. Just a couple of other points. In 1738-220 and 230, those are both violations, and they're punishable
220, actually just in the version I have, I think it's just 220, I apologize for that, is punishable as a violation and in reference to AS 1255. And what I would recommend to the committee is potentially just specifying right in the statute exactly what the penalty is, and in particular a fine of an explicit amount. In the initiative, if a person under 21 provides false evidence of age in order to obtain marijuana at a marijuana facility, it's punishable by a fine of up to $400. Referencing 1255 instead of sort of an explicit dollar amount will bring in the gamut of penalties that are specified in 1255 and potentially import a penalty disproportionate to the act or to the conduct, which then might denote criminality and entitle the person to the right to counsel and the whole panoply of rights attendant to a criminal case. With regards to 1738-230, that criminalizes the use, display, or possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana for somebody who's under 21 but at least 18. That may be subject to a challenge under Raven to the extent it criminalizes use by an adult who's over 18 in his or her own home. Oh. Just a few more points. I understand that 1738 and 270, I understand from the last committee hearing, is intended to be removed, but I did want to note that provision was problematic because of the disproportionate penalty that it imposed and the fact that treatment could only be done under the tutelage of the Department of Corrections. And similarly, 1738-290, which is the forfeiture provision, I think I understand that there may be some changes to that as well, but that also potentially subject somebody to getting their car forfeited for a violation, which is maybe a disproportionate penalty. Something that came up at the hearing on Friday was the confidentiality of certain marijuana-related conduct by those under 18. And there is a provision in the bill, as you're aware, that would remove from juvenile jurisdiction and put in the adult court certain behavior or certain conduct by those under 18. And I just want to note and reiterate that it is possible for the legislature to, even if you're going to decide to put in adult court marijuana-related conduct by somebody under 21, it is still possible to write in a provision that would make those records confidential so that the violation can get the juvenile's attention, and there's a provision for that for getting the person into court, but won't have lifelong consequences and certain and potential barrier effects that would affect the minor for the rest of their lives. So I would certainly encourage the committee to consider making records for minors confidential when it comes to marijuana-related offenses. And I'll have one final comment, only because this came up at the hearing on Wednesday. With regards to probation, in Section 26, there was concern that there was no exception for, this is page 28, for, page 18, for the use of medical marijuana, but certainly an exception could be built into the bail conditions and the probation conditions that would allow a judge to exempt someone to still provide for marijuana use for somebody who's on probation or parole if they have a medical marijuana card. And I'm happy to take additional questions as I'm able, but I know the committee would like to move on, and I did did get across my main point about the misconduct involving marijuana offenses, and I'm happy to continue to work with the sponsors' offices on this bill.
Excellent. And Senator Coghill.
Just to clarify, it could still be a violation and still be left in juvenile, which would keep it confidential?
I think that's an open... I know Nancy made at the court system testified that violations are generally... violations by minors are generally handled in adult court, and that's true. In particular, that's true because 4712030, which is on page 80 of the bill, specifically exempts from juvenile jurisdiction most sort of minor offenses that we were talking about on Wednesday. So speeding tickets, violations of other traffic statutes, minor consuming alcohol, those are specifically exempted from juvenile jurisdiction and put for the most part in adult court. So the
I think the committee could, if it wanted to, keep violations by marijuana-related violations by minors in juvenile court. That, you know, putting it in juvenile court would require or would sort of set in motion a good deal of process. In other words, you know, that would get the juvenile probation officers involved and potentially invoke the right to counsel. If the committee wanted to treat them as violations in adult court such that there could be sort of an immediate consequence for the juvenile by means of a court appearance, which I think the ABC board, and maybe Cynthia Franklin could speak more to this, I believe the ABC board is recommending sort of that all MCAs become violations and that the penalty be reduced so that there's sort of an immediate that there's increased enforcement. In other words, law enforcement is willing to give kids tickets for this conduct because it's not going to result in extreme penalties and lower the penalties in order to get the minor into court. But I would also say that the committee could, if it did that, if it decided to keep violations in adult court and just give them sort of low penalties, you could make that confidential simply by writing a statute that does so, that requires the court system to make those records confidential on court view and in the court system.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'll talk about that a bit later.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Two things. Number one, do you have any concerns over the definition of public place? And number two, do you have any concerns over allowing the police to order a blood or urine test?
Through the chair, thank you for bringing up that point. I do have a concern, just starting with your second question, about the police ordering juveniles to submit to a blood or urine test for the purposes of determining the marijuana content, and that's on page 69. And I understood, I think, that requirement was coming out, and it certainly would not be consistent with the way adults are treated to not require a search warrant for something as intrusive as a blood draw. And there doesn't seem to be any reason to make the law less protective for juveniles when it comes to the need to get a search warrant. So thank you for pointing that out. I did want to put that on the record. And with regards to the definition of public place, I understand that it is tricky to define public place. I think there's sort of risk. There's on either end, you don't want to criminalize. You have to be careful, I think, not to criminalize using marijuana in a place that's private but potentially subject to public view. And by that, I'm thinking of your back porch or your backyard. I don't think the initiative was intended to criminalize use in those areas, even though potentially if you didn't have a fence, somebody could see you smoking marijuana. So that's on one end, and I don't think the definition of public place in 1181-900 would criminalize that. But by using the definition of public place in 1181-900, you do draw in places of business, and there may be an intent to allow marijuana use in places of business, say at a private function or a private party. And so it might be worth examining whether the definition of public place in Title 11 could be amended to allow those sorts of things.
Any further? Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony.
The opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. Okay, Cynthia Franklin, thank you for being here in person today. We appreciate it. You've had the opportunity to view the new draft, and we've heard a little bit from you. I'd love to hear any further testimony, if you'd put your name on the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the Director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I just had a couple of matters about the draft, and I wanted to share some information relating to our work on alcohol minor consuming. I thank Tracy for bringing that up because it is, I believe, good for you to know that. I've been in hearings where questions have been asked about how minors consuming alcohol is currently addressed and whether or not the minors consuming marijuana should mirror what is in Title IV, and we have done so much work on that. Diane Casto, who's here today in the audience, chaired our underage drinking subcommittee on the Title IV stakeholders work group, which began meeting in May of 2012. and now has a bill that we've been working with Senator Michiki on in terms of trying to get the bill before the legislature, revisions to Title IV. So I want to address that as well. But before I do that, I just wanted to make a couple of comments on the current draft of SB 30 and just make sure that these items were on your radar. So regarding the section of the bill that talks about the municipal law.
Can you give us page numbers if you
want? Yeah, I'm trying to find it right now. I have it marked and I got distracted. So the section that talks about municipal law, I'm not being permitted to subvert the intent of the state law, the primacy section. There are some questions that are coming up before the Committee on Regional Community Affairs regarding definitions of municipality and local government. And in the bill itself, in AS 1738, in the definition section, which is 1738-906-4, local government means both home rule and general law municipalities, including boroughs and cities of all classes. So I'm on 1738, sorry.
I'm sorry, could you, through the chair, could you provide a page number?
I was looking at 1738. Do you have that before you?
What section does it have?
Not your bill, 1738, the ballot measure. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I misled you. We brought up a point regarding the fact that if we're going to have a local option that is similar to what we have in alcohol, local option elections are not limited to municipalities. There is a provision in Title IV that allows a village to create a perimeter and have an established village for purposes of alcohol local option. And 1738-904 in combination with 1738-110, local control, would not allow an established village to have a local option election for marijuana. So it's a problem that we've brought up in other hearings, in which I believe in SB 30, there's just a section. Let me just look for it just for a minute, because I didn't mark it when I was looking before. Thank you. Section 128, which is on page 74. Thank you so much for the help.
Okay. All right.
You can see there that, again, you're only including home rule and general law municipalities. So theoretically, under this section, if there were established villages that, in other words, if the definition in 900 was amended to read so that the same entities, the same local governing bodies who can hold alcohol elections could also hold marijuana elections, you just want to be sure to track those changes through to this section so that they would not be able to create anything that was inconsistent with state law by virtue of not being a municipality or home rule city. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be sure as I move forward and advocate for including established villages that I don't leave them out of other sections that would then create tricky loopholes in primacy.
Senator Michiki.
How was the local option created currently in the law for alcohol regulation?
So Title IV provides local options for municipalities and then a separate section of local options for established villages. And there's a section in Title IV that instructs the village how to create a perimeter and become an established village for the purpose of holding a local option election. And Senator McKitchie, through the chair, also there is a difference in 1738.110 for local option between marijuana and alcohol. And that is that in Title IV, all local option selections are accomplished through a vote. And 1738.110 provides a local government, which is currently only defined as a municipality in 1738, could also choose a local option through an ordinance. Obviously, an ordinance applies more clearly to a municipality than to an established village. So it may be that if there is an opportunity to include established villages in local communities that can opt out or choose from a menu of options for marijuana, that they might still have to do it by a vote, just as they have to do it in Title IV. But as it stands in 1738, none of the local options technically apply to an established village because of the way the authors defined local government for 1738.110.
Senator Coghill.
Madam Chair, I think I'm on the same page, sir, because I actually had the liberty of an amendment drafted up that would take that very thought and try to put it into this, and so I might I might give it to you for your perusal, but I'm not offering it yet because I'm waiting to see what all transpires here, because my guess is with much of this movement we'll see another version come rolling out, and I want to have this language passed around, so maybe I'll get it to you as well.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that that you were aware that that was being discussed elsewhere and that it might affect some provisions of this bill.
Perfect.
The other matter concerning the new misconduct involving marijuana in 200 and in 220 at SEC, the issues that Tracy brought up in concerning the amount, I had a similar but slightly different concern between section, and so now I'm on page. On page 29 and 30 and 31, well, actually just page 29 and 31. So my concern was that in 200 on page 29, 1738-200, you have some activity defined as a level of crime with marijuana with an aggregate weight. And then on page 31 under 220, you have manufacturing marijuana without a weight. And clearly, it's clear from reading this and comparing it to 1738.020 that what you're attempting to capture here is those items in 020 that say that are the prohibitions. You can't, but you're talking about your personal use and possession amount. And my concern between the two provisions is that what we're looking at from our perspective is making sure that we have rules in place so that anyone who attempts to open a business to manufacture, provide, or deliver marijuana outside of the licensing scheme, we have the appropriate tools to address that black market activity. And one of the things that I know from my years of prosecution is that if you have another section that reads close enough to what you're shooting for, that persons could try to claim, for instance, that Section 220 is what should be applied to their conduct, that violation versus the Class A misdemeanor where you're really trying to get at their conduct. So I had talked to Amy about this earlier, and I just wanted to take another look at that and make sure, and it sounds like you're going to be taking another look at it anyway. So I don't really have any suggestions, but just to make sure that if you're parsing out those activities between illegal commercialized activities versus going outside the bounds of your personal use, that there's some way of making that clear so that someone who is engaging in illegal commercial activities cannot hobble onto those personal lower personal use penalties and say, hey, you have to give me that lower level of offense because it also applies to my conduct. So some way to differentiate between the two sets of conduct. And then finally, I would like to address the recommendations of the Underage Drinking Subcommittee of the Title IV Stakeholders Group regarding minor in possession of alcohol, what we currently call MCA or minor consuming alcohol, although 416.050 says possessing or consuming alcohol. The committee was aware, as were many individuals working in the criminal justice system, that 416.050 has a lot of issues associated with it that have caused many stakeholders in the criminal justice arena to question the effectiveness of that current penalty for minor consuming alcohol. The provisions that you have and where you have placed a minor possessing or consuming marijuana in the I-draft of Senate Bill 30 are much closer to the work that the Alcohol Stakeholders Group ended up at in terms of the appropriate penalty or what might be a more appropriate penalty for minors consuming or possessing alcohol. So what came out of that work group is a recommendation of stripping 416.050 of the requirements that are currently present there for mandatory alcohol treatment or education, mandatory community work service, and then the driver's license implications that begin by building up a repeater and habitual scheme through 416.050 that has ended with the Court of Appeals saying that by virtue of all of those provisions, that minor consuming alcohol is no longer a violation, even though it says it is. Even though the law says it's a violation, the courts say, nope, not a violation. And the reason is because you have all of these requirements that make it look more like a crime. And if it's a crime, then an individual charged with that offense is entitled to a jury trial, is entitled to a public defender, and is entitled to many due process rights that take it out of that minor offense category. So what the stakeholders group ended up with is a recommendation to move minor consuming alcohol back into that violation category. And with a mandatory court appearance, as Tracy mentioned, but so a $500 fine for any minor consuming, regardless of whether it's your first, second, third, et cetera, but when the young person appears at the magistrate court proceeding, if they appear, they have the opportunity to receive information on how to reduce their fine by proactively seeking treatment or education relating to alcohol. So that is the revision that came out of the stakeholders group and that's going into Title IV work.
Senator Coghill.
I appreciate that work, and we're working really hard trying to figure out how to bend the curve, and that may be very well one of the good tools, but we've been talking here about the confidentiality issue, and it sounds like, you know, the reputation harm is what people are concerned about, and I personally think the reproof of life is probably the better thing here. So did you have that discussion along the way?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, yes, we did. It was a major concern of the Underage Drinking Subcommittee and of the court system and other justice officials who had weighed in on minor consuming throughout the years that we were working on those issues. Initially we came out with a recommendation of the confidentiality that Tracy mentioned. The problem with confidentiality and a minor offense, which is the category that the minor consuming is, we're recommending that it be moved back into that category, and the category that you have minor consuming marijuana here in SB 30. The problem with requiring full confidentiality on those matters is it would require a magistrate to hold an individual closed hearing for each matter. And the numbers on these offenses are high. And really the point of bringing minor consuming back into a pure violation category was to bump the numbers up, because what was happening, because of the way the statute is currently written, is we have a high level of decline in dismissals, a loophole where basically they're falling out of the system without any consequence or enforcement whatsoever. And so what we worked out, sort of, with the court system, with apologies to Nancy Mead, general counsel for the court system, who hasn't fully signed on to our solution yet, but is getting there. What we came up with was, and what was ultimately approved by the steering committee at the end, was a method to have the offense in court view while the case was open. So in other words, when the officer files the ticket for minor consuming alcohol, it's a mandatory court appearance, and so it's going to appear in court view throughout the time that the individual is given to appear before the magistrate and request a trial if they want one. If they default, the case is closed, and upon closing, the case would disappear from court view. And that compromise was reached with the idea of keeping the court system being able to move the cases through, because they are high numbers, and with a full confidentiality, it would require the magistrate to close the, if a officer in Anchorage, let's say, busted up a big party down in Rabbit Creek and wrote up 30 young people for minor consuming alcohol, the magistrate would have to shut the courtroom down 30 times for each of those individuals to have a fully confidential hearing. And when we spoke with the court system about that mechanism, it did not seem practical or workable. So the solution that we came up with was to have the case be viewable in court view while it was open. And then once the case closed, whether it be by default, by appearance, by reduction of fine, whatever the end of the story was on that ticket, that case would then disappear from court view. So there would be a relatively short period of time that the case was in public view. But then in terms of looking back and looking a young person up when they were applying for their first job at Colati Brothers, for instance, unless they had an open case, a potential employer would not find those cases on court view.
Thank you. That helps me understand.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So if we adopt your procedure, then would that entitle the individual, the child, to a public defender? If they didn't show up to court, would the court issue a warrant for their arrest?
No.
If they didn't show up for court, what would the ramifications be?
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So the minor offense rules are found on the court system website, and they apply to a conduct that's designated as a violation with a fine not to exceed $500. There are no warrants issued for failure to appear in those cases. If someone fails to appear and the fine is already a set amount, which is the case with our recommendation for minor consuming $500, then upon a failure to appear, the court enters a default judgment, and the judgment becomes what's called a criminally delinquent fine that is then collectible from the PFD. That was a big consideration for the group, because many of the issues that we've seen over the years in minor consuming alcohol has been an attempt to get parental involvement. And because you can't really charge a parent, there was a lively conversation by our underage drinking subcommittee over a number of weeks where the group realized that if the minor's PFD was garnished because they hadn't told their parents that they'd gotten a ticket, that would be one way to bring the matter to the attention of the parents. And regarding warrants, the minor offense procedures specifically prohibit any arrest warrants from being issued for a failure to appear. Now, there are two types of minor offenses. There's mandatory court appearance and optional court appearance. In an optional court appearance case, there are some payee cities in Alaska where one can go and pay their fine without ever appearing in court. And if they do that, then the case doesn't make it into court view at all. So we did consider that because, you know, there was a great desire of the group to keep the young people out of court view if at all possible. But the problem with the optional court appearance is there would never then be an opportunity for a young person to come into court and hear about the opportunity to reduce the fine by seeking treatment or education. And that was a large piece of the work of the group. We really wanted to have a way where there was a stiff fine if no one addressed the conduct, but there was a way that was workable and practicable within the court system for a reduction of the fine if the young person was proactive and said, maybe I need to learn something about the use of alcohol or address my use of alcohol by seeking treatment, that would then be recognized and that would be recognized in the form of a reduction of the fine from $500 to $50. So it's actually stated in the intended language of the revisions that it would be a high fine reducible to quite a low fine to give an incentive to reverse the current scheme, which is a lot of sticks, and to create a quite a large carrot, a $450 carrot, if you will.
Senator Wilkowski.
So, and the other question was on public defenders. And I guess, I mean, maybe you could just address, there are obviously going to be kids who are going to contest this, and there's right. This is going to create trial time, which is going to create prosecutor time, which is going to use judge time, and this seems to be not a small number of cases. I mean, how many cases are we talking about? So I guess the questions are, number one, do they get a PD? Number two, how many cases are we talking about? Number three, how many are likely to go to trial? Are we going to need more resources for this?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, in the minor offense category, there is no right to a public defender because there's no jail time associated with that offense, and the fine is relatively small, a maximum of $500. You may have a trial before the magistrate. The Alaska rules specify that no prosecutor is required for that trial. So when I was the municipal prosecutor for the city of Anchorage, I technically signed off on all of the requests for trials for traffic cases, but our prosecutors did not appear unless the officer called and said, this is a special case, could I get some attorney help on this? And so generally speaking, no prosecutor or defense attorney time is used on minor offenses. The officer presents his own case to the magistrate. The rules, the minor offense procedure rules, provide for the way the trial is conducted, and the magistrate makes the decision. And again, if the magistrate makes a decision on an offense where the fine is a set amount, then the magistrate has no choice once the defendant is found guilty but to impose the set fine. So when Tracy was speaking with you earlier about, you know, whether or not there was going to be a set fine, and some of the fines in 1738 do not match the minor offense procedure rules. There are a couple of offenses that say a fine of up to $750, and then there's the one that says a fine of up to $400. So there were certain sort of random maximum fine amounts in 1738 that don't really line up perfectly with the categories of offenses that are already defined under Alaska law. But generally speaking, if the legislature assigns that conduct with a penalty of $500 or less, it's going to be designated as a mandatory court. If you say up to a $500 fine, and for instance is 1738.040, the penalty in the provision for consuming marijuana in public says a fine up to $100. So when we spoke to the court system in November, they said, we look at this, we immediately see this as a violation. It's a mandatory court appearance with a sliding scale fine of up to $100. Any municipality could pass a similar provision that does not have a fine exceeding $100, and which would then be in not violate the primacy and impact. So that's when Anchorage, remember, passed their ordinance that was identical to 1738.040, but said it's a flat $100 fine. They made that the optional court appearance minor offense, and got that into their code with their own definition of public. If an APD officer writes someone up on February 24th for consuming marijuana in public, if they write them up under the Anchorage Municipal Ordinance, then it will be a $100 fine, and it will be the definition of public that Anchorage has assigned. If they wrote them up under 1738.040, it would be a mandatory court appearance for a magistrate to determine where the fine would come, from $0 to $100, and it would be the definition of public that we have on the state level, which we don't have yet, but which we hope to have on February 24th by virtue of an emergency regulation from the ABC Board.
All right. One last follow-up, Madam Chair. And police officers all across the state are pretty strapped. I know in Anchorage they are. Is this going to result in our police officers spending a huge chunk of their time sitting in court prosecuting 15-year-old kids?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I can't tell you the number of offenses that are going to be written up. My anticipation would be that people are excited about the initiative taking effect, about seeing their voting power in real life on February 24th, and that there might be a bubble of public consumption at the beginning. How many of those people ask for a trial, I believe, is going to depend on how many of those people are in the spaces that we might consider to be the edges of public, such as you heard earlier in terms of, you know, where does the public end and the private begin, in terms of trials for people who are out in an area that we typically all consider and recognize to be a public space. Or walking down the street here in Juneau, I would be more surprised to see a lot of trials for that. But that's something that's unpredictable, unfortunately, in a criminal justice system, how many people are going to ask for a trial versus just pay a fine. Generally speaking, in Anchorage, in general, minor offense trials, they happen. People challenge their tickets, and they're a manageable amount of trials, and we will hear from the court system, I anticipate, if there's a sudden spike in minor offense trials, but it's not something that I would necessarily anticipate or expect after the excitement of the first few days wears off.
I've got Senator Michiki and then Senator Carkill.
So perhaps, you know, it becomes legal on the 24th, perhaps we should maybe not have any of the public consumption fines kick in until after the weekend on the 29th or something. So one of the primary reasons I am sponsoring the rewrite of Title IV is more reasonable minor consumption regulations. I've just seen the adverse effects on young lives, and I think it was the wrong way to go initially. I think it's a much better solution. So I appreciate all of your work on the rewrite, but I guess, and I don't know if this question is for you or for Cynthia or Hillary, but how can we dovetail the likely outcome of the Title IV rewrite with this bill that's not currently existing law so that we have something consistent?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, I would be happy to and have provided you with the language. I thank you for the mention of the work on Title IV, because I love talking about liquor these days. It's much easier to discuss the marijuana. And we did work so hard on that effort and did anticipate with the passage of the marijuana bill that that work could potentially be eclipsed. It is very important work, and in the first hearing, when I heard a senator or representative at your Joint Judiciary Committee say, what do we do on alcohol for minors? Maybe we should just copy that. In my head, I was screaming, don't copy that. Don't copy that. Copy what we have come up with since then. And, you know, we do know that what we have done doesn't work. We don't know whether the revision and the proposition will work, but the hope is to try something a different, more reasonable, that results in less collateral consequences. And one of the main collateral consequences of attaching, as we've seen with Title IV, of attaching too much to this conduct for minors consuming a substance that's legal for people over 21. It's important to remember that's a status offense. That's not actually a crime, because it's not a crime if you're over 21. It's only an offense if you're under 21. And so it's not like assault or theft or other things that we think of. And one of the big problems with attaching those consequences that we've been discussing with people as we've rolled out the Title IV revisions across the state is to remember that whenever you attach a requirement, you have to think through what the consequence is if the person does not meet the requirement. So even though Title IV, 416.050, a first offense, is a violation. There's a requirement of mandatory alcohol education. And if a young person does not show up at the Native Justice Center or Volunteers of America or wherever the court has assigned them to go, the consequence for not showing up is a warrant for their arrest. And the minor offense procedure rules say you can't have a warrant to arrest someone for a minor offense. And so how that happens legally is that they're not being arrested for the drinking behavior. Now they're being arrested for not complying with a court order. But the court had to make the order because the alcohol treatment and education was mandatory. So that's that stick approach that we discussed earlier. And the unintended consequences, where I have been sitting at the Anchorage Jail on the weekends and seeing young people come through on first and second minor consumings who are in jail and not getting out of jail anytime soon. So I think it's very important, and I think that you've done great work here in SB 30 in addressing the conduct in the form of a violation without attaching a lot of requirements that would end up with those unintended consequences. I would, especially when it comes to that rehabilitation section that the Public Defender's Office voiced some issues with, I would look at that carefully and keep in mind that there are ways to proactively encourage rehabilitation without creating a situation where if that is not engaged in, it ends in jail time. Because overall, you know, some of the objections that we've gotten to the suggested revisions to minor consumings are from judges. They say, well, you mean I'm supposed to treat an eighth MCA the same way as a first MCA? And that sounds pretty terrible when you say it aloud, but there are a couple of things about that. First of all, you don't really see a young person get to an eighth MCA without having other issues that bring him to the attention of either the justice system or the Child in Need of AIDS system. So when you actually try to chase down that data and chase down that numbers, the majority of young people who receive these tickets are first and never come back, okay? And then second of all, you have to go behind the good intentions of, well, let's force someone into treatment and keep in mind what happens if they don't go. If they don't go, if you've made treatment mandatory and they don't go, they're going to jail. So you just have to realize that on the front end when you write it and make sure that that is your full intention and that you understand what's really going to happen down the line from imposing that requirement, which has all of the best intentions behind it. You know, let's help someone and let's, you know, encourage them to get treatment. So what we've done here in Title IV is just flipped that formula around and said, hey, you know what, instead of saying get treatment or else, we're saying or else a $500 fine unless you go and you chase this down yourself, you show us the proof within a reasonable amount of time, and then you can have a significantly reduced fine. So I would encourage, as you look at that rehabilitation section and you look again at 220, which I believe is where you put the minor consuming marijuana, just to consider the language that we used there in revising 416.050, the suggested revisions to 416.050.
So, Madam Chair, if I may follow up, just I'll share that language with you. It's worthy of consideration for this bill. I think it dovetails nicely.
Excellent. Senator
Coghill
and Senator Costello.
Just a brief, you know, I found out today that between medical marijuana and this, we have two different ages, age groups. So it's going to be my intention to say with parental, either parental consent or parental participation or something like that. Isn't that what we do when you're going into a licensed facility with an underage person? It has to be accompanied by a parent. I'm trying to see how they dovetail.
That's Senator Coghill through the chair. That's correct. We do have a couple of different types of licenses where young people might go on licensed alcohol premises with or without an adult. So we have a restaurant designation permit that you get so that a young person can come on accompanied by someone over 21. And then our restaurant eating place license has different rules around that. So that's why sometimes when you go on alcohol establishments, there are areas that are off limits to individuals under the age of 21, and then there are areas where beer or wine is served, and people under the age of 21 with a parent or guardian can be there. But but obviously when it comes to marijuana licensing, there are going to be some different issues. Certainly the smoking of marijuana doesn't exactly accompany a meal the way that a glass of wine or beer might accompany a meal. And in terms of the licensing, I know that there are issues swirling around, you brought it up earlier, public consumption, and would that exclude a public place where the public was invited and could consume marijuana. Both of the other legalized recreational states have stayed away so far from having places to publicly consume marijuana, and there are some sort of private clubs and other rules that people are using to get around that, but that is a level of licensing and regulation that I have warned people that might be year two. Just in terms of getting through these types of licensing and addressing these issues with regard to marijuana, taking on the issue of whether or not there is somewhere you could go and consume marijuana with others in a the type of environment where you go to a bar, for instance, and consume liquor with others, is kind of outside the scope of our very starting places with these licenses, but it's certainly something that will have to be addressed eventually. But much of this is sort of advanced marijuana work that we feel like we have to get through the beginning stages of the marijuana work before we get to that. But I am glad if you'll allow me to address the medical just briefly. We provided the document that was approved by the ABC board yesterday entitled Preliminary Consideration of Implementation of 1738 that just had some thoughts. And regarding the work that we did in Colorado, we did see the interaction of their medical marijuana rules having a great impact on how the recreational market evolved, and frankly was some problems and issues with the recreational marijuana market. What we found when we were sitting down with Oregon and Colorado at a table there for a couple of days was we ended up considering ourselves very lucky that we're starting from scratch, because having the overlay of medical marijuana dispensaries before you begin with a recreational has caused a lot of problems and frankly created something that I had never heard of before we went to Colorado called a gray market. So there's the black market, and then there's the legal market, and then there's the gray market, which is their medical marijuana grows that have evolved to be these large warehouses full of people cultivating marijuana in the name of being caretakers for patients. While we have a small caretaker provision in 1737 for our 831 registered medical patients, that has not been abused to the extent that the caretaker provision in Colorado was abused, which led to opening of medical marijuana dispensaries 4 years before there was any such thing as a dispensary license. So we actually met and spoke with and toured a business that opened their doors for business in 2006, and we sort of expressed shock and said, but the first licenses weren't issued until 2010. And they said, yes, that's right, but there was nothing that said we couldn't, so we did. And we've seen a couple of instances of that here in Alaska just since the initiative passed, but generally speaking, over the years, our medical marijuana registry has been very contained, and we haven't had anyone who's taken that and run with it and tried to create these giant loopholes for themselves using the medical caretaker provision. The way that I like to talk about it and express it, because we as Alaskans can relate to it, is I like to relate the medical marijuana caretaker provision that we've had and the way it's been used as more akin to a fish or hunting proxy than to what it kind of got blown up into in Colorado. So it is truly a situation where if you're too sick to grow your own, that statute provides a way to have someone grow it for you. But to date, until we passed this and until some locals with ambitions began speaking with national groups about how they could get ahead of these licensing provisions, we haven't had anyone just out and out abuse it and say, I'm going to open a medical marijuana dispensary because you don't have anything that says I can't. And I have a great amount of faith and hope in the people of this state that they truly want regulated marijuana, that they don't want chaos. So I think that if we could keep a medical where it has been, 831 registered patients is a very manageable number. What they saw in Colorado when they opened medical dispensaries was a jump from 2,500 registered patients to over 115,000 registered patients within 1 year. And so if we create and carve out a separate category for that and say those people are going to enjoy special privileges, we're going to have a lot more people applying for that special category of medical marijuana consumer. And it is my great hope, and I express that in this document as well as the board's, that we not do that to ourselves, because by not creating two separate regulatory environments, we avoid having that gray market that's in between that is super challenging to law enforcement.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Okay, well, my apologies. Senator Costello.
Thank you, through the chair. And just for the sake of transparency, I was wondering, since we're considering the recommendations by the Underage Drinking Subcommittee for the Title IV rewrite, if we could have a list of the membership of the committee, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Senator Costello, through the chair, yes, the ABC stakeholders group was comprised of 70-plus members from all different walks of life, and I can send you a document, I can send all of you a document that describes the stakeholders' work and has a list of all of the participating members of the group at the back of the document.
That's a big group.
And through the chair, thank you. I'm aware
the subcommittee was not, I'm sorry, that was a mistake. The subcommittee wasn't 70-plus members, the entire group.
I'm aware of the work that's gone on for Title IV rewrite, but I just think that for the sake of transparency, it's nice to have a list of the individuals who are promoting the changes that we're considering. Thank you.
Certainly can provide
that. Thank you. Okay. We're adjourned.